Securing Your Church Network is the ministry session we're about to hear from Anthony King. Brother King currently serves as the Director of Technology Services for Lancaster Baptist Church. This session was part of the Spiritual Leadership Conference 2010, hosted by Dr. Paul Chapel and the Lancaster Baptist Church.
Start off by saying we're glad that everybody's here today. And we're going to go over some things about securing your church network. Some of this might be kind of basic stuff for you. Some of it might be more advanced stuff for you, depending on your experience level. But I'm just going to try to help share some things that have worked for us. This conference, and if you go home with this impression, you really kind of miss the whole boat. This conference is not to tell you how to do things and how you're doing things wrong, okay? This is not a conference to show you how great we are and how we've got the best of everything. We're trying to tell you what works for us, what hasn't worked for us, and hopefully through this kind of give you some good ideas and stuff like that. I teach a single adult Sunday school class. I just sat in with Pastor Tim Rasmussen in that session, and he said some things. There wasn't anything earth-shattering in there that I'd never heard before in my entire life, but he said some things that just spurred some ideas in me that I thought, wow, that's good. I want to think about that. I want to write that down. I want to talk to my wife about that and see if there's something we can implement here. So that is kind of the whole goal behind this conference. Put some tools in your tool bag and hopefully help you along the way. One of the things I do want to offer to you, first of all, is my email address. Write this down in your conference notebook or somewhere where you will not lose it. Email address is anthony.king@lancasterbaptist.org. Now, here's the thing. If you email me with a question or some direction or something I said or something you're thinking about doing, something like that, chances are I will respond to you before the end of the day because I hate a cluttered inbox, okay? But before the end of the day, I'll do it, I promise. Normally, I try to respond to emails usually within the hour. Here's the thing. If you call me and leave me a voicemail, there's a very good chance you and I will never speak again until next summer when you come back to Spiritual Leadership Conference, okay? Is everybody catching my drift here, okay? Easiest way to get in touch with me is via email. You can call, leave a voicemail here at my voicemail at the church. The best way to contact me via email, anthony.king@lancasterbaptist.org. So if nothing else out of this entire session helps you, write that down. If you ever have any questions in the future about what's good for this, what's good for that, what do folks use for this or that, shoot me an email. I'd be glad to help out in any way that I can there as well. Let's have a word of prayer, and then we'll jump into this session. Lord, we thank you for your goodness to us. We thank you for the great preaching that we've heard already. We thank you for how you stirred our hearts, and I pray that you would continue to use this conference as an equipping time for your servants, and I pray that you would take this time that we have together to hopefully be a help to some folks as well. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen. The title of this session is Securing Your Church Network. Again, we're going to take a look at a couple different aspects. We're going to talk about some of the hardware that we use here, some of the software that we use here that we use to secure our church network, some of the policies that we have in place to keep things nice and tight and secure and things like that. And we'll be discussing those throughout this. At the end time, what we're going to have is we're going to have a question and answer time. Maybe somebody say, hey, you know what? I use this product. It was junk. I use this. It was really great. And just kind of share some ideas that we have amongst one another. Then after everybody leaves, if you have any questions, I'll stay up here till the very last person leaves. I think my mic's falling down here. I'll stay up here till the last person leaves. If you have any questions whatsoever, I'll hang out as long as you want to be here. And if you have any questions, we'll be happy to answer those for you. First of all, taking a look in your notebook, some things you need to take a look at in considering securing our church network. We need to take a look at, first of all, our network infrastructure and everything that entails. First of all, when you think of securing things, you need to make sure that you have some type of, let me see if my slides will advance here. There we go. Some type of firewall device. This kind of goes without saying, but you wouldn't want to just connect any old computer directly to your cable or DSL modem or whatever type of connection you have. You want to have some type of firewall device there as well. For us, we use a Microsoft Threat Management Gateway 2010. TMG 2010 is a short acronym for that. It's basically a Microsoft server that sits with one network card directly plugged to the internet, one network card directly plugged to our local area network, and it filters traffic between there. Again, that's what works for us. If you want to go with a Sonic Wall firewall for your larger networks, or if you want to stick with your cable DSL firewall that you have there, that works as well too. That's just one of the things that we use. And it works well for us. But whatever you do, do not take your computer and directly connect it to your cable modem. You're asking for trouble there. So you want to have some type of firewall device there as well. Also, when we talk about wireless network access, we want to make sure that we're encrypting our wireless traffic that we have on our network. It's funny, now when you buy these cable, DSL, wireless, gateway, all-in-one devices, they have a little sticker over the power port that says, do not plug this thing in until you first ran the little CD. I'll always love that. I'll always take the sticker off and throw it away and plug it right in anyways, right? Yeah. Because that's what IT guys do, right? We just disregard all the manuals, disregard the instructions, just go right at it. But those things were in place because what happens is people just plug it in and, hey, I've got internet access and I'm not even plugged in. This is great. Not knowing that they're sharing their internet access with the entire world. And sometimes people say, well, it's not that big of a deal. I want to give guests internet access and things like that. We'll talk about that a little bit later. We have open Wi-Fi for you folks to use here on campus while you're here this week. We have it in the dorms. We have it in the lobby of this building. And it would appear that it's just wide open willy-nilly. That is the case, but it's set up a little bit different, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But we want to make sure that if we're using wireless, that we're using some type of encryption on there with some type of password. I highly recommend that you don't use the WEP encryption, W-E-P. That is very easily cracked. You want to use something like the WPA or stronger. And again, this is not a lesson on wireless encryption protocols. You can Google that stuff all day and read more than you could ever hope to learn. Next, I want to make sure that we secure our internal network as well. And what does that mean? That basically means that all of our users should have their own usernames and passwords. We don't want to share usernames and passwords. We don't want to, even worse, leave our entire network unprotected. We want to have some type of way to authenticate our users with a username and password. Let me back up for a second before I go on. Speaking of wireless here, if you're looking at purchasing wireless access points, the ones that I absolutely love and I consider to be the best that money can buy for a decent price is the Linksys WRT54G. And if you do any research on these guys, you'll know that they are incredibly, incredibly awesome. Here's the thing. This wireless router here will cost you about $60. Incredibly cheap. But here's the thing. There is a custom firmware that's freely available on the internet called DDWRT. And this is where you're going to get your bang for the buck in DDWRT. If I'm talking over your head, when you get back to your church, ask your IT guy. He'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Basically, what you do is you buy this router here for $60, and you flash the firmware with this DDWRT, and it basically turns your wireless router into a super router. I mean, everything, every possible configuration you can imagine. If you want to provide guests a wireless access, it can take you to a portal where it will require people to log in before they're able to access the internet. It'll take people to a custom page before they're able to access the internet. If you want to do that, it'll allow you to filter based on only these computers can connect to the network during these period of times, things like that. You'll get a lot of incredible functionality out of that, and it really makes this wireless access point, this router that you have, into a router that if you were to buy off the shelf, $400, $500, $600 wireless router. So incredibly good stuff. Let me say that before we travel on with wireless. That's your tip of the day, I would say. And even if you're just doing this at home and monkeying around with it, I use DDWRT on our router at home just to kind of play around with it. Some different functionality. I'm able to connect to my computer from home by using some of the routing functionality on it. Totally awesome stuff there. I didn't want to be remiss in not mentioning that. Back to our internal networks, again, want to make sure that all of our users have their own usernames and passwords as well, which leads us to the next point. No guests should have access to our private network. Let me say this again. I'll say this slowly. No guests should have access to our wireless private network. Dave Kramer is our room host back here, good friend of mine. We bought a house about 6 months ago, and Dave is a housing inspector. He was the guy that I called. He's a good friend of mine. We've been friends for years, serving the media ministry together. He came to me about 6 months ago, and he goes, hey, my wife's practicing in the choir for the Christmas program. He says, it's 2 or 3 hours long. Can I get on the wireless access here and just check my email and stuff like that? I love Dave as a brother, but I said, Dave, no, can't do it. And he was like, come on, you know, but he understood. He's like, okay, that's fine. I figured you were going to say no, but that's the case. Dave's a good friend of mine. I don't think Dave would do anything nefarious. I don't have to worry about Dave doing any type of packet sniffing on my network or trying to probe servers to find out what he can get into or anything like that. The guy just wanted to check his email and surf the web, you know. There's nothing wrong with that. But here's the thing. We cannot allow guests access to our private network. We have way too much sensitive information on our network. For us, we have, in churches, we have counseling records, we have financial records, we have giving records, we have just about anything you could possibly imagine. Now, and hopefully, again, if we have our network locked down appropriately, nobody should just be able to stumble on these types of things, but we shouldn't allow guest access to the private network. I was doing some help with a friend who has a computer network at a church a couple hours from here. And he asked if I could come down and just kind of take a look and see how they got things set up, went through, looked at all their servers. Yeah, everything looks good here. And we got ready to go to lunch. I said, do you mind if I check my email before we go to lunch? He goes, no, not a problem. He says, I said, well, what about your wireless? I said, do you have a password? He said, I don't have a password. I was like, ding, 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 red flag number one, you know. So I connect up to his wireless network there, and it gives me an IP address. I get straight out to the internet. So I start pinging around on his network, and I type in ping space server, which basically says, hey, answer up if there's a computer out here named server. First thing it comes back, response from 192.168.1.2. And I was like, wow, that's his server is named server. Like, that's like, hello, don't do that. You know, that's security lesson number two. Don't call your servers server, okay? For us, we name our servers. We started off in the tribes of Israel, and we got past 13 servers, and so we started off with some other names out of the Book of Chronicles. Man, you got to love that. You know, most people can't even remember the names, much less, you know, like poke around and accidentally stumble upon it. So I find the server named server, and so I tell my Windows computer, you know, --/ server --/ C dollar sign. For those of you that don't know, it says connect me to the C drive on computer server. Bam, it pops up wide open, and I go, oh, this is bad, you know? And so I think to myself, for some reason, he must have left read-only access open to the server. I can't imagine why he would do it, but I'm sure he had a good reason. So I right-click in there and say, create new text file in the root of the C drive. And I create a new text file. I create text in it, save it, everything. I thought, wow, I wonder if I can delete this file. I'll delete it. And I go, hold up. Nobody's going to lunch yet, okay? Because we have a server who is connected to an unsecured wireless network who has no username and password authentication on it, and it has read-write access to the C drive. We got big-time problems, okay? Now, luckily, we were able to get that squared away, but here's the problem. You give a guest access to your private network, they're going to find things you don't want them to find. So for us, what we did, especially for this week, is we segmented off our network into two separate segments. We have our private network, which is all of our church administration. We have a totally separate network, and the two don't touch each other. A totally separate network where you guys can get on, you can check your email, and if you get a wild and crazy virus and it breaks out everywhere, it's not going to affect any of our day-to-day operations. Totally physically separate, and it's not going to cause any problems there. So again, a lot of times, again, say telling some deacon who's been at your church for 20 years that they can't get on your wireless network might cause some heartburn, but you got to stick to your guns with that. And make sure that if we need to provide a service like that of giving them guest internet access, we need to set something up in advance for that. But we can't just give people guest access to our network. Other things we need to take a look at are shared our servers and our shared files that we have. First of all of our shared files should be secured. At no point should we ever have any shared files or folders that don't have username and password authentication. This is pretty elementary, but it happens a lot more often than you think. A lot of people say, well, you know, I just want everybody to be able to access this. When you say everyone, that means everyone, and that's not necessarily a good thing. When I first came here as the IT director back in 2003, there were some shared folders we had out on the network. The guy who had been doing our IT administration at the time was doing it part-time, about 10 hours a week, as a favor to our church, not a paid staff member, just a volunteer. So I come in, first thing I do is I go to the shared directory and I type in counseling as a search in that particular shared directory. And I came up with about 15 or 20 counseling notes of people who have been counseled for everything from bankruptcy to marital infidelity. Open it up, I have full read-write access to these files. That's really, really bad, okay? So we need to make sure that these shared files and folders are secured in some way. Again, username, password authentication for us. We use a Windows-based platform. Much to the chagrin of our graphics department, we are primarily a Windows-based operation, okay? We use Microsoft Active Directory. We use Microsoft file servers to share that out and make sure that we lock down our files and folders at the share and the file and folder level as well. And again, we give access to things on a need-to-know basis. We break up all of our shared files and folders into things like college, Striving Together, Bookstore. All these have their own separate shared folders. Now, a lady working on our college administration staff has no need to get to the Striving Together files. There's no need for that, so we lock down access that way. And again, from time to time, we have a share called Graphics. It has all of our shared graphics that we have, every book cover that you see on anything that Striving Together has ever done, to the PowerPoint slides you'll see in tonight's service. Every aspect of that is found on a shared folder called Graphics. from time to time, people say, hey, I need access to the graphics folder to get pictures from Team Camp. Great. There's no problem with them having access to that. But again, we wouldn't want to give them read-write access to that because they might be able to delete folders or add their own files and things like that to it. So we set up a group called Graphics Read Only. And so if you need to access pictures from Team Camp, you get put in the read-only group. You can read files on there, but you can't make any changes to them. So we want to break down our access to that only on a need-to-know basis. Other things we need to take a look at. Also, we need to be meticulous in the backing up of our critical data. If you don't have some type of backup plan in place, and if this is the only thing you got from this conference, take it home, get it taken care of today. Backups these days don't have to cost a boatload of money. They don't have to be incredibly difficult to set up. There's some freeware software that you could download that would back up your software for free for you. There's no excuse not to have a good backup system in place. And we need to determine what is considered our critical data. For us, we use, for some of our critical data, such as our church management software that we use an offsite backup service called Carbonite. Carbonite, basically, you load it on a computer and you say, back up this stuff every single night, and it uploads it to the internet and across your internet connection overnight. And there's the great part about this is it is unlimited. I can back up as much data as I can fit over my pipe in a given night. For us, we back up probably about 6 gigs a night to Carbonite. We set it to kick off at 11 o'clock. It copies all these files over to across the internet overnight while we sleep. Wake up the next morning, everything's backed up off-site. This building burns down. Our server room burns down. Great, we've got an off-site backup of that. For the rest of our critical data, what we'll do is we'll back it up to just a regular hard drive and take that hard drive home and stick it in a fireproof safe in someone's home. And that gives us off-site backup of any of our critical data that we have. If our server room were to catch on fire, it would be a major catastrophe, but our data is secure somewhere. And that's the most important, is determining what that critical data is and making sure that it gets backed up on a regular basis. So, again, I highly recommend Carbonite for that and some type of off-site backup. Back when I first started in IT back in probably the mid-90s, to get a good backup solution that would back up more than 5 gigabytes, and I'm saying 5 gigabytes, right? Anything that would back up more than that would cost you anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000. And it was the process of pulling these tapes out and putting new tapes in and rotating the tapes out, and some of the tapes would cost $250 each. Now, I mean, you can buy a terabyte drive for $75. You know, you have no excuse whatsoever for not backing up your data and getting it off-site. Again, if you're using Microsoft file servers, I highly recommend that you use what's called the volume shadow copy, VSS as it's known. Basically, what that allows you to do is allows you to say, hey, roll back this file to where it was at 7 o'clock this morning. Or somebody says, hey, I accidentally deleted this folder 10 minutes ago. I can look at the shadow copy of that from 7 o'clock this morning and restore it within less than 30 seconds. It's not a matter of finding the right backup. It's not a matter of, oh, we didn't run the backup last night. It runs automatically in the background. Microsoft Volume Shadow Copy, also referred to as the Volume Shadow Service, VSS, will be totally awesome for you. Anybody in here Mac fans? We've got a few. When they roll out Time Machine, you know, you can roll your system back to this particular time in a given day. You can take these files that you've been working on all day and roll them back to a certain time. That's basically the concept behind what the volume shadow copy is. The only thing, Microsoft did it about 5 years earlier. Anyways, moving right along. I'm just kidding with you guys. I think Macs have their appropriate place. I won't say where that place is. But anyhow, make sure you're meticulously backing up that critical data. Incredibly important. This one right here, incredibly important as well. Some type of power management system. You need a battery backup system, an UPS unit, uninterruptible power supply. And depending on how many servers you have, how many critical pieces of equipment you have, will determine how much you should spend on these types of things. Surge protectors, incredibly important as well. Here's the thing, with your surge protectors, don't buy the ones that are hanging on the checkout line at Home Depot, okay? The ones that cost $299. Do not put your critical pieces of equipment on that because very, very bad things will happen. We found this out probably about 6 weeks ago. pretty fun stuff. It was in the middle of a chapel service in our college. and the right projector in the main auditorium there went really, really bright, and then it went a little bit dim. And we thought, man, we probably blew a lamp or something like that. So I sent one of my guys up there with new lamps to go up there and replace it. He goes up there to find a power strip that has scorched a circle in that room. Basically, the power strip had caught on fire and caused this really bright spark, and then it went away, and so we thought we'd blown a lamp. Come to find out, the power strip, we take a look at the back of it. It's not a power strip at all. It's called a temporary power tap. It's basically one of those ones you pick up from Home Depot that are never meant to do any type of surge protection whatsoever. So here we have one of our critical pieces of equipment, our projector for our main auditorium, plugged into a $3 temporary power tap from Home Depot, okay? Don't do that. Bad things happen when that's the case. So you need to have some type of power management in place for that. I like the APC brand of UPS units because they have the capability to, they have some really cool software called PowerChute that's built in that when your server goes, loses power, when your system loses power, it clicks over to battery backup. It says, okay, I've got 15 minutes before I totally lose power in this battery. When I get down to 5 minutes, I'm going to start shutting the server down. So then it sends at 5 minutes, it'll send an alert to the servers. Hey, I'm running out of battery backup. Start shutting things down. And Windows will shut itself down nicely and totally, completely shut off. And that way, we've used that in several instances where power to our campus will get cut. And then everybody starts freaking out. Oh, my goodness, what's going to happen? And so we don't ever, in that case, have to worry about our servers. They're on battery backups. And when the battery backups get too low, they'll automatically shut themselves down. So that is your power management. Make sure you've got something in place for that. We think about desktops, a couple things we need to be aware of. First of all, some type of antivirus software. I'm still blown away by how many people don't use antivirus software. This right here is Computers 101. If you don't have some type of good virus scan software, get it today. Microsoft actually came out with an incredibly good, and all of you Apple fanboys can joke about it, but about how you don't need virus scan software and all that other good stuff, but we'll save those for later. Anyways, Microsoft actually came out with Microsoft Security Essentials, totally free product. You go to Microsoft's website to download it. Great part about it is it's virus scan software. It works hand in hand with Microsoft Windows Defender for malware, anti-malware as well. Really good stuff. It uses, for us, we used to use McAfee Virus Scan Enterprise. It worked really, really well for us. The problem is it was very processor and memory intensive from time to time. Microsoft Security Essentials doesn't have that same draw on system resources that we've seen. And it works incredibly well. And it is the favorite Baptist price, which is free. You got it. So that's always good stuff. Anti-malware software, from time to time you're going to need this stuff for junkware that gets loaded on your computer and stuff like that. If you have your computer set up in the first place appropriately, you shouldn't have to worry about stuff like a lot of anti-malware. If you and we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get into how do we protect from the things out there on the internet. But a good anti-malware software that I've used is called Malwarebytes, B-Y-T-E-S. Really, really good stuff. Again, it is free. So if you ever get a system that's hung up with some type of crazy malware or something like that, you can download Malwarebytes, and it'll 99 times out of 100 clear everything out for you there. Also, you want to make sure that your users have limited permissions. We don't want to give typical users administrator permissions at the desktop. That way, they can install whatever software they want to. That causes problems as well when they do get a virus, or in the event that they get a virus or some type of malware software, is the fact that they have administrative privileges at the local computer, which causes all types of other problems as well. For us, we give users permissions at the desktop to basically, typical user permissions, they can install certain pieces of software, certain pieces that they can't. You can lock down a lot of that stuff if you're using a Windows-based platform through Microsoft Group Policy that you can do from the server, and that is a help as well. That's about it as far as the desktops go. As far as general policies, we have all of our users sign a user agreement form, and I'm actually going to pass you guys out a copy of our user agreement. Take a handful of these and pass them back there. Good day. Thanks. I like to pass this out every year because some people say it's helpful to them. Some people say it's not. If it's not helpful to you, just throw it away. It's fine. It won't hurt my feelings. But every user, and when I say every user, I mean every user. If we have somebody who's coming in to work on printing our bulletin out for us on They're going to work only on Saturdays from 1 to 3. They're 2 hours a week on Saturdays. They're going to be working on the bulletin. Guess what? They will sign one of these user agreements because we want to make sure that they understand what we expect of them, and also that we have a we're covering ourselves legally in the event that something were to happen on our network here. I'm not going to take the time to read through all of it. Basically, some of the things say, here's what's allowed on our network. Here's what's not allowed on our network. Here's what you can use your email for. Here's what you can't use your email for. Don't respond to spam. Don't click on links that you get in, via email and things like that. The very last page, let me draw your attention to this as we talk about limiting access on a need-to-know basis. Our Human Resources Department actually receives this last form here, and they determine, based on the user's requirements, what their needs are. For example, how long is this person going to work with us? Is it only a temporary hire? Is it someone who's only going to be working for 6 weeks? They'll notate that on this sheet of paper here. They'll also note here who that person reports to, who their manager is, in the event that there's an issue, who do we talk to about it. And then down at the bottom is their level of network access that they require. All that information there, and then at the very bottom of that, the Human Resources Director approves that, and they communicate that to the IT department, and then we create their account from there. Nobody, and I mean nobody, gets an account created until they have filled this out and met with our Human Resources Director, because that lets them know, here's what's expected of you on our network, and here's what you're legally obligated to uphold. And in the event, the very handful of times that we've had problems on our network with people doing things they shouldn't have been doing, one of the first things my pastor will ask me, did this person sign and see our user agreement? Not because he wants to take legal action on them, because he wants to know, did this person know that they weren't supposed to be doing these things here? And we can say with a definitive yes that they did, because we have a sheet of paper signed by them in their employee file that they know that. So for us, one of the things that's worked well for us, user agreements. Next thing, regular password changes. For us, we change our passwords every 45 days. That means if someone hands their password out to their aunt or uncle or somebody like that to come in and do some work, that password's only good for 45 days, and they'll have to change it from there. From every now and then, we get users who it's more trouble for them to change their password every 45 days than it is to actually have to go and reset it for them. We've made very, very few exceptions for this, and sometimes I get grief for it. But you should have passwords changed every 90 days at the very max, I would say, just because it always keeps is in good keeping with security practices. Let me say this too. As far as your critical server resources are concerned, you should change your passwords on a regular instance. Anytime a key member leaves who has that password, anytime, you should change those passwords for that system. For example, our servers that we have, if one of the guys on my team leaves tomorrow, before he leaves, we will change every single password that he knows the password to. That way, we can never be too cautious and something like that. But also, you have multiple systems from time to time. Maybe you got a password on your router. Maybe you got a password on this server over here. Maybe you got a password to this service that you subscribe to on the internet and things like that. A good way to, again, keep, you don't want to use the same password every place, because if that password becomes compromised, it also compromises the rest of your passwords. One of the programs I use to help me keep track of my passwords is a program called LastPass. I want to say that there's a free version of it, but the version that I use, I think I paid $20 for the year or something crazy like that. It's fairly cheap. LastPass is also a lot like KeePass for those who have used that before. KeePass is an open source freeware software that you can download for that. The great thing I love about LastPass is it's web-based. In the event that I'm over at your house or at your church or something like that and need access to a password that I have, I can log on to LastPass's website and access my secure password vault there. I have a list of probably 175 different passwords that I keep track of, and there'd be no way on earth, short of writing all these down on a sheet of paper somewhere, to keep track of that. This software here allows you to do that and keep track of all of your passwords. If I wanted to share that password with somebody, I could do that through some different things they got on their site. Really great stuff. Highly recommend you checking that out. There's also a Firefox, Chrome, an Internet Explorer plugin for LastPass, so you go to these websites, it automatically logs you in with your password. That way I don't have to keep track of all those passwords and try to remember them. So make sure you're changing your password on a regular basis. Also, a lot of this comes down to good user training. Usually about once a year, pastor will do some training with our staff on what's the appropriate way to use our network system, things we do, things we don't do. From time to time, he'll have to admonish our staff for sharing their passwords, which is a big-time no-no around here. Why? Because you signed a sheet of paper saying you wouldn't tell anybody your password, and now you have, and that makes you a liar. So we from time to time, we got to hammer people about sharing their passwords and things like that. But again, just good user training. I love it when people send me an email saying, hey, I got a link from my grandpa that says I should go here and download this so I can see some funny pictures. Should I do it? You know, no, don't do it. You know, I love it when people send that to me. I hate it when they say, hey, I got this really weird Hallmark e-card in my email, and I clicked on it. This black screen came up. It went away, and I don't know what happened. My computer's running really slow now. It's like, no, you didn't click it, did you? Yes, I did. So I always hate that. But I love it when people say, hey, this kind of weird thing came across. What should I do with it? And that goes back to good user training so that they know what to do when they receive something suspicious. In addition to that, we need to make sure that our data is physically secure. What we don't want to do is we don't want to leave our critical pieces of equipment, our critical servers, just out in the open under somebody's desk where a lot of people have access to that. That leads to places where people could destroy it by sabotage. They could pull drives out of your system. They could pull the power cord from the back. For us, we have a server room that's dedicated to, this is where our servers reside. Probably less than 10 people on our entire staff have a key to that room because we want to make sure that all this stuff is locked up tight. Nobody has access to it. So physical security is incredibly important. If you don't have that in place, you definitely should. And a lot of this comes down to administrative diligence, too, just making sure that we're on top of it. We're taking a look at, on a regular basis, how things are operating. For me, one of the best pieces of software that we have is a program called Servers Check. I think serverscheck.com will get you there, something like that. And basically what this does is it's a software that runs on the server, and it will do whatever you tell it to do. For us, we tell it to ping all of these servers and make sure that they're online. Check drive space on all of our file servers to make sure that they don't fall below 70% of utilization. Tell me if this particular machine goes into 90% memory utilization. Tell me if I lose connectivity to Google.com. And it will say, it'll do whatever you want it to do. When these things happen, it can restart a server. It can restart a service. It can send you an email. It can send you a text message. Whatever you want it to do, it can take care of that for you. So a lot of times when people call, my phone rings, I say, yes, I know, I'm working on it, because they don't have to tell me that it's down. I already know that it's down. So that's incredibly helpful, and that comes back to administrative diligence. You can also have it send you an email alert anytime a certain event comes up in your event logs on your server. So if I see a security alert come up on one of my logs on my servers, I can have it alert me automatically on that. Incredibly helpful piece of software there, and helps in the administration of a network. Other things to take into consideration, almost everybody wants to know about spam and content filtering. For us, what we use, and again, I recommend this for larger networks. If you have a smaller network, some of these might not necessarily apply to you, and we'll talk about what would in just a second. But for us, we use the Barracuda Spam Firewall. For us, over the last 3 years that we've had it, we have received 22 million spam email messages. That's a lot. From time to time, people say, I'm missing XYZ email. Could you look for it in me in the spam filter? And probably that happens maybe once a week, that one legit email actually gets caught in our spam filter. But a lot of times what I'll do is I'll look, and I'll have to look through pages and pages and pages of spam email that they missed out on to find the one email that they were supposed to get. So, incredibly worthwhile. The thing I love about the spam firewall is that they don't charge you based on the number of users that you have. A lot of software will charge you if you have X number of users, it's this. If you have X more number of users, it's that. There's one price on it, and when you buy it, you get basically unlimited amount of users. Same thing for the Barracuda Web Filter. Again, both of these products are made by the same company. For us, it's worked out incredibly well. Both of these have an incredible amount of reporting that's available to you. The Web Filter, I can say, I'm going to allow Joe over here, I'm going to allow him access to whatever he needs access from 9 to 5, but after 5 o'clock, he can't access anything at all. I can say, hey, I'm going to allow this particular person over here who updates our church Twitter account, I'm going to give them access to Twitter, but for the rest of our church staff, Twitter's cut off. I can say, I'm going to allow this person access to Facebook, but nobody else gets access to Facebook, and this guy only gets it for 10 minutes a day. I can be really granular with that. I can say at a high level, I want to block all these categories, but then I can get really granular with it as well. I can also say, show me how much time this particular user has spent on the internet in the last 7 days or in the last 30 days. Show me all websites this person has visited in the last 30 days. Show me all the blocked websites that all of our entire staff have tried to access in the last 30 days. Incredible amount of things that we can do as far as reporting goes with the Barracuda Web Filter. That's one of my favorites. For smaller networks, and again, people who can't really justify the cost of something like that, I highly recommend OpenDNS. The great thing I love about OpenDNS is it is free. OpenDNS, basically what you do is you make changes to your DNS server settings on your network, And then all of your requests to the internet go out to OpenDNS, and it basically checks to see if it's authorized or unauthorized. Just to kind of give a, I think I have an eraser. No, don't let me use my hand. Quick networking lesson for those of you who are maybe new to all this network stuff. Out here we have the internet in the big cloud with an eye. Here we have you with your firewall, which you must have, which we've already talked about. Here is you and your local computer network. This is you and your network. There we go. Now, anytime you want to go to, say, for example, CNN.com, computers on the internet communicate via IP addresses. Something like 65.22.241.68 would be an example of an IP address. That's how computers communicate from via IP address to IP address. So your guy over here, he just wants to get to CNN.com. Let's just say CNN.com. He has to ask somebody, what is the IP address of CNN.com? That generally goes out to a DNS server on the internet. Now, for us, we have our DNS set to use OpenDNS. So it goes out to the internet and it says, hey, this guy over here on the LancasterBaptist.org network is trying to access CNN.com. Is that allowed or not allowed? If it's not allowed, he comes back and says, sorry, you can't access that. It's not available to you. Or if it is allowed, he comes back and says, yep, no problem there at all. And with OpenDNS, I get to specify domain names that are allowed, not allowed. I can specify categories. Don't allow any types of gambling. Don't give me any advertising. Don't give me personals, dating. Don't give me any chat websites, things like that I can block at the OpenDNS level. And basically, anybody who tries to access the internet, when they go to make that first DNS query to the internet, the OpenDNS will say yes or no. The great part about this is that it works independently of anything else that you've got going on. I don't have to buy any special software. I don't have to buy any special hardware to make this work. You can visit their website, opendns.com, for a lot of good stuff there. And basically, when you do that, you create your own account. You say, this is my network, and these are what I want to allow and not allow. These are the domains you can access. These are the domains you can't access, and so forth. And the great part about that is it allows you a lot of flexibility. The downside of OpenDNS is it doesn't allow us to do individual user tracking. For example, if I see through my OpenDNS console that somebody's been trying to go to XXX.com, I can't tell who did that. I would never know. I just know that somebody on my network's been trying to do something they shouldn't have. So that's one of the downsides of using OpenDNS. But for us, our network looks exactly like this, and we actually have our Barracuda web filter here before it goes out to the internet, but we also use OpenDNS. So the first thing it does, it hits Barracuda and says, can this guy get to this website or not? If for some reason something was calculated wrong or improperly, it would go through then to OpenDNS, and OpenDNS would block it. So for us, we have two layers of security here before it ever gets out to the internet, so we can be pretty well sure that nothing bad is gonna get back to us. So that's kind of OpenDNS in a nutshell. If you have more questions on that, see me on that. The great part about this is that you can use this in conjunction with your wireless router at home. You can use it with your network, regardless of how you set it up, however how large or small it is, you can use OpenDNS. OpenDNS about 2 weeks ago came out with a really cool product called Family Shield. Again, this totally free. And you don't have to set up an account with this. You don't have to configure rules or settings or anything like that. You just plug in their IP address into your DNS settings, and it automatically blocks all types of porn and stuff like that. Any type of adult content will be automatically blocked by that. And again, a totally free service there as well. From time to time, people ask me questions about what's a good spam blocking software, what is something I can use for that. I've never had a lot of good luck with client-based spam filtering software. So what I generally try to do is for people with smaller networks, I try to steer them towards Google Apps for Domains. And if you're not familiar with this and you have a large or a small network, you should really get familiar with it. I highly recommend this for small businesses, for small churches and things like that. Here's the thing. Google will allow you to have your own customized Gmail interface with your domain name. So I am FirstBaptistChurchOfKing.com. How about that? Or King, California. How about that? That sounds good. So First Baptist Church of King.com is my domain name there. I can create my own interface there that uses my domain name through the Google Apps. Looks just like Gmail, works just like Gmail. I get a Gmail or Google Docs account with this that I can save documents to and things like that. And it allows me to create multiple mailboxes for users in our organization. This is actually what West Coast Baptist College uses for our email. And it works really, really well. You can create multiple accounts on there. You can do calendar sharing and things like that. Works really well for smaller networks. thing I love about this too is it syncs very easily with your mobile phones. If you got a BlackBerry's, if you have iPhones, if you have an Android device, it syncs really, really well with those automatically right out of the box. So, and it, the great part about this is it uses Google's spam filtering technology for the inbox there. So it filters out a lot of your junk there if you're running on a smaller network. Highly recommend that. The cost of it is free. Gotta love it, man. That's all I have as far as this section is concerned. Does anybody have anything that I covered that you have questions on or things that have worked for you that might work for others? Anybody want to share anything like that? Anybody have any questions? Sir? Yeah, you feed it a list of categories, first of all, and then you can say individual domain names after that, and it does all the work for you behind the scenes. Nope, don't have to have the IP address at all. And 9 times out of 10, OpenDNS will be faster in resolving those names than your typical ISP is. Because, yeah, the same thing going on. Say, for example, I use Time Warner at home. If I weren't using OpenDNS, it would go out and query Time Warner's DNS servers and bring me back this IP address here. OpenDNS is actually incredibly faster than Time Warner in my responses that I've had there, which basically speeds up your internet connection too. So you got another layer of filtering and it speeds up your internet connection. Hey, sign me up. Anybody else? All right, folks, again, if there's anything we could do for you while you're here, please don't hesitate to let us know. You got my email address. If I can ever help at any time, don't hesitate to drop me a line. I'll be here until the last person leaves. Thanks for coming. Enjoy your time.
We trust this ministry workshop session was a blessing to you. Plan now to join us in the second week of July for Spiritual Leadership Conference 2011 as Lancaster Baptist Church celebrates 25 years of ministry. Let us know if there is any way we can be a blessing to you.